this morning.
Thanks, Rob.
Thank you. Thanks.
Well, it is so great to be here. We love SIFT. We love the local church, and the book really is about local communities making a difference. If you were to ask us, how do you fix the national narrative, I think we'd say that's above our pay grade. I'm not sure how to do that. But I think locally we can make a big difference. So we love the local church. I want to mention one thing. I'm also part of Viola's newly launched Center for Marriage and Relationships with Dr. Chris Grace. Where's Dr. Grace? In the back. And we are putting on two things we just want to tell you about real quick. One is you can leave, you can grab this. We're putting on a marriage conference on Biola's campus, October 6th and 7th. It's very inexpensive, and our focus is on grace within a relationship. So you can grab that as you leave. And then Dr. Grace and I put together a podcast called The Art of Relationships, and it's really gotten quite a following. So Dr. Grace is a psychologist. It's great to hear all those different aspects. And so go ahead and pick one up, and you can listen to the podcast if you find it helpful. We just want to put that out there.
This podcast has made Tim, what was the phrase, an internationally renowned
Communication
scholar.
Yeah, it's awesome. I always wanted to be one of those, and I didn't know the bar was so low. I may have been an international scholar for years and not known
it. You didn't know.
The bar
That's
was
right.
so low. Yeah, this person introduced me, and it was like, I was like, I can't wait to hear this guy. Who is he? What in the world? But so, Rick, why don't you tell him a little bit why we wrote the book, what we were thinking when we kind of wrote this?
Yeah, so, you know, part of what happened, Tim and I taught a class together, and we've done a lot of things together over the course of the years, and so this is partly a percolation of a lot of conversations. But the other thing that I think dawned on both of us is that we seem to be living in a moment in America where we are no longer able to talk to each other. We can talk past each other, we can talk at each other, but we can't seem to talk to each other. In fact, one of the things I just had, you know, a new start of classes, and I spent some time talking with my class. I teach a class called Money, Sex, and Power. So there's a certain amount of disagreement that is going to be built into the issues that we're talking about. And I said one of the goals of the class, if you think of class objectives, one of the goals of the class would be to achieve disagreement. Because usually what happens is two people end up thinking they disagree, but neither one of them could actually articulate the viewpoint of their interlocutor in a way that that person would nod their head and say, yes, that's what I believe. They end up disagreeing with some sort of straw man or an imagined stereotype of the person, and they think they've actually disagreed with each other. And go, you haven't even talked to each other yet. And until you can say what they believe in a way that they understand it, you can't even disagree. So achieving disagreement becomes actually a major feat. And I should note, I'm not opposed to achieving agreement. That's fine, too. But I just want to say, guys, in our current climate, achieving disagreement is actually a major feat, and it's pretty valuable and oftentimes the first step to actually creating a more positive climate, less argumentative. So some of these things were big things in our mind as we went to write the book.
And on a personal level, we wrote it because we're frustrated. Like most Americans, we're frustrated at what's happening in our national discourse. It's what Deborah Tan and a Georgetown linguist calls the argument culture, and we're going to talk more about that in a little bit. But a new survey came out just last year. 69% of Americans, when surveyed, said they feel like incivility is at crisis levels within our country. I think this is a golden opportunity for the church to step up, for us to show what does it actually look like to speak the truth in love, to have both of those be accomplished. And so Winsome Persuasion is our attempt to say, we need to get out there. We need to be in the public square. We'll talk about the Benedict option just a little bit. We get asked about the Benedict option all the time. And though we'd love to have his royalties, we'll talk about it. It's not actually as radical as we thought it was. I'm actually listening to it on audiobook right now, and I think he's got some great points. I think we agree on a lot of things. But we believe the church has to be the church, and the church needs to be the church locally. And there's a thing called social capital. And we need to talk about really controversial issues, but do it in a way that's distinctively different from how the culture is trying to do that. And so that's kind of why another reason we wrote the book.
Let me, so as we mentioned, failure of public discourse. Things have been collapsing. One of the things that hit me is we were, actually this all happened after the book was done, but kind of the collapse of free speech. I grew up, as you can probably tell, in the 60s and 70s. I remember the Berkeley free speech movement, right? I remember people standing up and you know, being able to say the most crazy things and Berkeley proudly defending that. So the modern version of this is the 2016 Berkeley Free Speech. Now, this began in September. I think this was actually an event that happened before the election. But that's Milo Yiannopoulos, if you don't recognize him. And if you don't know the name or the person, I don't know how he achieved this, but he was actually able to be permanently banned from Twitter. So whatever the threshold for congenial conversation is required to participate on Twitter, he failed to achieve it. So, yes, he's an inflammatory, white supremacist sort of a guy. I don't even know what all he... Bottom line is, yes, he is a provocateur rhetorically. And so they invited him to campus, and as you can see in the pictures, the response was flaming riots before he got there, so they actually canceled his speaking engagement at Berkeley. Now, it is weird for me to think about Berkeley as the bastion of free speech, and then this guy can't even give the talk. That said, it was Milo Yiannopoulos, and there's part of it that says, thank God he didn't talk at least one time. You know, the fewer times he can speak, the happier I probably am. But it was interesting. It led a freshman at Berkeley, Pranav Jandala, to found what he called Bridge USA. And he was upset that this person couldn't even give a talk. He thought that was wrong. And so, as he noted, our organization hopes to create a future in which our campus and our country are venues for free and fair political discussion and debate from all sides. We stand for the preservation of spaces where political ideas can be shared and challenged without fear of violence. So, he organized this campus group. First thing they did was to have an event on immigration policy. So they had, the Democratic students got to invite their person, the Republican student group got to invite their person. They were going to do it back-to-back weeks. So the Democrats brought in Maria Echaveste, a Clinton advisor who had expertise in actually dealing with immigration issues in the Clinton White House. And she was able to spoke on April 17th and had a wonderful little event where they talked about this. April 24th, they're supposed to bring in the other side. The other side decided to bring in Ann Coulter. Now, yes. Ann Coulter is certainly, she probably flew to Berkeley on an airplane with two right wings. But that said, she's occupying what I would have to say is somehow within the broad sphere of the bulk of the American populace in a way that Milo Yiannopoulos was not. She writes bestseller books. She's, she may be more in the Rush Limbaugh vein than the, wonderful compatibilist person. But yeah, for heaven's sakes, she's somewhere in the real world, so to speak. The response was riots. And she was scheduled for that, but they basically had to cancel the debate for fear of violence and the university's inability to assure student safety. Now, I have had people complain, that's Berkeley. They, they love it when the communist speaks and all this. And I'm like, look, actually, if I was the regent in charge of UC Berkeley, I might have canceled this too, because he wasn't saying that Ann Coulter shouldn't be able to speak. He was embarrassed by the fact that he couldn't provide safety for her to be able to speak, and probably equally embarrassed by the fact that he had to worry about providing safety for a person like Ann Coulter to be able to come and speak. And frankly, I'm worried about that too. And so the first thing we want to point out is that the issue of public, the failure of public discourse, we're not talking to Christians here saying, what's wrong with you guys that you've made this climate? We're saying, this is our climate. It is characteristic in many ways of evangelicalism. We'll talk about that. But this is the world and the water that we swim in. These are the conditions that we have.
Yeah, I'm not going to engage you. I'm going to shut you down. That's now a huge strategy in parts of the public square. I'm going to shout you down, or I'm going to make it impossible for your group to be represented. And so that's what we're going to have to work on eventually as the minority perspective, what we call a counterpublic, is we have to enter into that sphere and how do you gain credibility in such a toxic communication climate.
I actually dropped this slide to save a little bit of time, but two weeks after that, I think her name was Sarah Brown or something like that, but anyhow, an editor of a communist magazine spoke at Berkeley, obviously with no problems. She, no problem with riots and burning in the street. And one of the things that she talked about was exactly that people like Ann Coulter, in effect, have no right to speak.
Yeah.
They're beyond the pale.
Yeah.
And so this is where I'm going, wow. And I would like to think whatever my biases are on that issue, in other words, if it had been the opposite side that had been unable to speak because of riots, I would still be concerned that we're unable to carry out this kind of a dialogue. And I feel really bad for our dear college freshman there who goes through all the work of organizing this wonderful organization with a beautiful vision exactly to create safe and nonviolent dialogue, and he can't do it.
At Berkeley.
At Berkeley. Yeah. That gives you pause for thought. Charlottesville. So Tim and I sometimes feel the need to apologize. It's as if we got Donald Trump to be elected to do promotion for our book. because every time I open the page, we're going, well, here's another one, you know. And so the Charlottesville thing, these are just quotes, and this reinforces what Tim was saying about the perception where people really are saying, wait a minute, this has gone from just being another issue to being a life-critical issue for our country. So you know the story of things that happened at Charlottesville. Saturday's chaos erupted as neo-Nazi skinheads, Ku Klux members, and other white supremacists arrived for the rally. Counter-protesters were also on hand, and the two sides clashed, with people throwing punches, hurling water bottles, and unleashing chemical sprays. Good, vibrant public dialogue, right? Some came prepared for the fight with body armor and helmets. Now that fact should give you pause, that you show up for the public protest bringing helmets and body armor. Videos that ricocheted around the world on social media showed people beating each other with sticks and shields. The governor of Virginia, Mayor of Charlottesville, lumped the blame squarely on the rancor that had seeped into American politics. Particularly the governor here said he spoke to Trump on the phone and insisted that the president must work to combat hate. On Sunday, he reiterated that angry political rhetoric needs to stop. And I think, you know, we view Charlottesville in one sense as, oh, this crazy person drove their car down the street and ran over people. But it's interesting to go, where did that come from? Yeah. And it came from a dialogue that people knew was going to be so bad that they brought their body armor to the discussion. That's our current communication climate. And that's tragic and somewhat scary. Yeah. Now, that said, that's the public. What about us Christians? How are we doing with public dialogue? It's interesting to think about this. I would like to say, I don't think Christians have ever said more in terms of speaking to the public square, and I'm not sure we've ever been understood less while we're doing it. So I would like to argue that our problem is not that we haven't been speaking publicly, but that we haven't been speaking well. The statistic I have here, a Barna poll indicated that 75% of non-Christians, so if we're asking how does our audience perceive the communication we have, 75% of non-Christian ages 16 to 29 believe evangelicals are too involved in politics. So if you're worried that we're not being heard, I would just like to suggest the evidence points the other way. People know we're talking. They just, for whatever set of reasons, aren't really thrilled with what we're saying or aren't hearing what we're saying, perhaps because of how we're saying it. And here's one other thing that was really striking to me. Does the average American think more like us or more like an atheist or a skeptic? So back to my, you know, age profile, I remember 1979, 1980, and the birth of the, quote, moral majority. So this is sort of the early version of the religious right. Jerry Falwell founds an organization called the Moral Majority. The implication was that you have a majority of people who are actually relatively, I think the best word to describe would be traditional morally. And all of the current of our country seemed to be going to this sort of progressive immorality. You know, the new morality is the old immorality sort of a thing. And so he was organizing the moral majority. My question is, if you fast forward 30 years, are we still the majority? So here's an interesting chart. What they did was they asked, I think this is a Barna poll as well, they asked, what counts as religious extremism? And so they asked adults this question. And they divided the people they talked to intentionally into kind of three different groups. They wanted to talk to evangelicals, and they wanted to talk to religious skeptics. And that makes the perfect sense to me that you'd say, hey, how do these people view religious extremism? Of course you assume it will be pretty different. And then you say, let me get my third group of people who are neither. You know, so the, quote, average American adult. I mean, their average in this case simply means that they are have relatively average religious views. They aren't skeptics. They aren't evangelicals. They're everybody else. So you probably can't read these because they're small. So if you were to attempt to convert others to your religious faith, 90% of evangelicals only think that's fine, and only 10% would say, yeah, trying to convert other people is radical. It's extreme. So most evangelicals say, that's fine. Go ahead and try and convert people. Teaching children that same-sex sexual relations are morally wrong. Only 1% of evangelicals would think that would be extremist. Believing that same-sex sexual relations are, whatever you teach your kids, if you think that, are you an extremist? Only 5% of evangelicals would say that would make you an extremist. Protesting government policies that conflict with their religion. 15% of evangelicals say, yeah, that's a little extreme. Quitting a job to pursue missionary work in another country. 13% of evangelicals would say that's extreme. Waiting until marriage to have sex. Who would think of a crazy thing like that? Well, most evangelicals are pretty good with that. Yeah, that's not such a bad idea. So 5% think that's religiously extreme. The other 95% or so, we're good with that. And all of you pastors will be glad to know 0% of evangelicals thought tithing was religiously extreme. So that's some really good news. There's not much out there, but there you go. There's your piece for the day. When you interview the skeptics and atheists, attempting to convert others, 83% of that population group thought that is an extreme behavior. 76% thought it's religious extremism to teach a child that same-sex sexual relations are wrong, and basically the same amount thought it was wrong to believe that yourself. Not wrong, religiously extremist to believe that yourself. 60% think protesting government policies based on your religion would be religious extremism. Quitting a job to pursue missionary work, 47%. Waiting until marriage to have sex, 34% think that's religious extremism, and only 13% think tithing. So there's a big move in favor of tithing. This is a very, very good piece of information. The average American, look at this. 60% of the average Americans think trying to convert someone to your religion is religious extremism. By the way, as evangelicals, doesn't that get you just a little queasy? Because this is sort of our hallmark, and now our hallmark is a sign of religious extremism. 55% of the average Americans think it's religious extremism to teach a child that same-sex sexual relationships are morally wrong. And roughly speaking, again, the same number to think that would be religious extremism. Protesting government policies based on religion, 51% of average Americans. 42% quitting your job to be a missionary. 24% think waiting until marriage to have sex is religious extremism. That one took me, I had to chew on that one for a while, because if they were to ask how many of you do that, I would have thought, you know, something, you know, we have a lot of people who don't honor that. But most people in my perception have said, oh no, it's a good thing to wait till marriage to have sex, but we all know most people don't do it. It's like it's a good thing not to text while you're driving. But, I mean, hey, but no. 24% think that would be a sign of religious extremism to not have sex before you're married, and about 11% of the tithing. So, here's my observation. We are not the moral majority. We are not in the majority. We are the outlying community now in the popular opinion of our country. And that should give us pause for thought about how we communicate.
Yeah.
Because it's very, very different when you can tacitly assume that everybody just basically agrees with you, but is a little muddle-headed in how they're thinking, and they just need a little help to think more clearly, and the good news is you've arrived and can offer that help.
Yeah.
So, you know, if that's the world you live in, you can approach communication in a certain way. But when you suddenly realize that's what you've got, and the average person you're talking for is far more like an atheist or a skeptic than they are like you, you suddenly go, wait a minute, we need to talk and act in a different way. So to summarize this, public communication is broken. Christian discourse has been neither winsome nor persuasive. Okay, shameless self-promotion of a title of a book. But that doesn't keep it from being true. We have not been winning people. We have not been persuading people.
Yeah.
And this is the thing that makes us stop and say, okay, we need to approach this differently than we have been.
So we explore the topic of a counterpublic. It's just an academic term. If you're the majority of opinion, you're the public. If you don't think your kids should be immunized when they go to school, you think that's unreasonable, you're now the counter to the public. So we just call that a counterpublic. It's very different if you're in the public and your communication goals are radically different. But if you're the minority perspective, now you have to think really long and hard. How do I get the dominant culture to listen to me? How do I get people that will shut me out in a heartbeat? Or I don't care what your experts say. You're not even a blip on my screen. How do we earn the right for people to listen to us? And that's what the book is really about, is local action to get the credibility to be able to talk about the things that we feel like we want to talk about. And not to have debates, but have good, authentic conversations where people actually consider our positions and not just out of hand dismiss them as being radical. So essential elements of a counterpublic. First, to be a counterpublic, there has to be opposition. It's important to recognize that oppositionality is primarily perceptual. Counterpublics emerge when social actors perceive themselves to be excluded from or marginalized within mainstream or dominant publics. So in other words, where's our experts when issues are talked about? Where's our perspective being represented? And it's not being represented, the evangelical perspective. And so we then have to say, okay, how do we think about engagement? And that's the next one. Go ahead, Rick.
It's coming.
Go ahead and pop that up.
There we go.
Engagement is the distinctive feature of a counterpublic. If you're not interested in engaging, if you just want to exist by yourself, hey, you do your sports program your way, we'll do our sports program your way. And the problem with certain churches, having been the interim teaching pastor of one big church, is we don't need anybody else. We can do everything we need on our campus. We can have our own sports programs. We can homeschool. We can take care of the people that are needy. We can offer marital counseling. We can do everything. We don't need the surrounding community. And that, to me, is a deep temptation to just withdraw and stay in the withdrawal mode. And that's the next one that we take a look at, is this idea of withdrawal. Those who constitute oppositional communication need to speak among themselves in moments of retreat, regrouping, reflection, or rejuvenation. It's hard being the counterpublic. I did all my education at UNC Chapel Hill, a secular school, where I was the most conservative by a mile when it comes to religious thinking and political thinking. Man, that gets lonely after a while. You start to get worn down. So there are times when we come together and we have to rejuvenate. We have to say, hey, is our strategy working in the community? And those are times of withdrawal. The biggest difference between us and the Benedict option would be this. He has if you read the first two chapters of that book, he believes that we're Rome in decline. And that's why Benedict left. He has given up on culture. It is irredeemable, culture with a capital C. I think he would say, that's done. It's over. The war's over. So let's remove ourselves and withdraw, but it's going to be a long season of withdrawal. We're more optimistic that God can make impact with culture with a small C. We think we actually can make differences in our communities, and our book is filled with options of people making a big difference. But let me just say one other thing. Our book is also filled with people like St. Patrick, Wilberforce, Harriet Beecher Stowe, who made a difference in culture with a capital C. So Wilberforce, over a 40-year period and one nervous breakdown, he eventually did turn Britain's thinking about the slave trade. So we don't want to give up on culture. We do think withdrawal is very important, but we got to be re-energized and get right back in there, because it's really enticing to be away from it, because it's so nice to be in groupthink. It's so nice to be away from it, and I don't want to go back into the messiness of all of that. So let's have them come to us, maybe, but we're not going to go to them anymore.
And the example, like Tim mentioned, of St. Patrick, it's one of these good reminders that we can paint our cultural moment as being desperately dark.
Yeah, yeah.
And I understand why we do that, but it's really good to go back through church history and go, have there ever been any other dark times? And it's like, guys,
yeah.
You know, we are basking in sunlight on the beach compared to certain other times and places they have. And ancient Ireland was one of those places.
Yeah.
It was a war-based, it was a piracy-based economy. And the pirates would only unite when attacking England, which is how Patrick first got to Ireland, by being captured as a slave when he was a teenager. During the off-season, they'd fight with each other. And if you ever look at ancient Irish artifacts, I always feel embarrassed when I give this talk at Biola. I don't know if I can show the pictures or not. But the pictures are of gods to whom they're doing human sacrifice that have got one human being in each hand, this great big open mouth, and they're dropping the two human beings into their mouth to eat them alive. And upon careful inspection, you'll discover, how do I say this delicately, that the god found that very exciting. So this was Irish culture and religion. We think of these nice little druids, sit around under an oak tree, smoke a few acorns. No. No, this is human sacrifice. Yeah. So this is what Patrick shows up on with him and his 12 buddies to say, how do we change this an island? And within 28 years, he converted literally a third of that island to Christianity and left behind basically the vestiges of every single ancient city in Ireland as a product of Patrick's missionary efforts. So we've had dark times before, and that's part of why I want to push back when people want to say it's so bad and it's so desperate we can't do anything. And I'm like,
these are
guys,
the last days.
Yeah, we have a heritage of people who have faced this before and done good.
We include a letter by Francis Schaeffer. Love Francis Schaeffer. Was just a brilliant Christian thinker, the founder of Labrie. But he writes a letter coming back to the United States. He'd been away for a while. And he writes to somebody back home, and he says, I fear for my beloved country, America. I do believe these are the end. This is it. And I say to my students, when was the letter written? Give me a date. And they're all saying, oh, I don't know, 1995, 1990, 1951. Think of what many people would say, those were the good, that was what we want to get back to, was 1950.
Captain Kangaroo!
Yes.
I mean, this was good stuff!
But it is interesting to think about that. That's pre-Roe v. Wade, that's pre-AIDS crisis, that's pre-sex trafficking as we know it today, that's pre-the pornography explosion, that's pre, right? So we have to be careful of having this, so this is a little bit controversial, but the reason we want the fear language, the reason we want to paint the picture that this is the end time and it's probably too late, but if you send us your money, if you fund our organization, if you fund our church, maybe we can gain more time. And fear is one, Aristotle said, it is the most persuasive thing you can do. So if we, and you know, we do this all the time. We get mailings just like you do. This is it. Gays are taking over America. And maybe, just maybe, if you support our organization, we can fight them back. And I think it's become a self-fulfilling prophecy that we now are so fearful that this is... And when you're fearful, and when your kids are being attacked, it's a different communication model. And we have to reject that kind of fear base, we think. Next, we're in the argument culture today. This is Deborah Tannen, Georgetown. Let me just tell you, say three attributes of it. There's many more. Consideration equals condoning in the argument culture. So if you just consider another perspective, that's seen as endorsing or condoning the perspective. Now, this becomes hugely problematic. So in one of my classes, and my wife gives me credit because I did this pre-tenure. So I had my students do something in my communication class that if, when they finished, they'd be part of 1% of American Christians who had ever done this. And that is read another book of another faith tradition. So they read the Quran cover to cover. Now, I got phone calls from parents. And things like this. One, I did not send my daughter to Biola to read the Quran. And I said, can I ask you why you sent her here? Because I want her to be a Christ follower. And I said, boy, we do too. Do you know 1 out of 5 people in the world self-identify as a Muslim? So if we're going to do the Great Commission, it's really good to know what's fueling another person's perspective. So this mother, this was so funny. Okay, all right, oh, good. But the first assignment was list 10 areas the Bible and the Quran agree with each other. Now I get another phone call. See, it's okay to rip the Quran. It's not okay to understand the Quran. So in the argument culture, the mere fact that we're reading Rob Bell is we're condoning Rob Bell. It's like, I didn't even want to tell this dear woman. By the way, I haven't read Nietzsche. I didn't even want to bring that up. I was like, holy cow, right? But in the argument culture, people are entrenched because consideration equals condoning. Second, we value monologue over dialogue. See, I wrote another book. It was called Authentic Communication. So in some of these interviews, people would say, okay, you define authentic communication. I said, okay. The conversation isn't decided ahead of time. It's a give and take proposition where both people can learn and maybe both people can realize that they're wrong. One radio host said, pause. Well, I think as Christians, then we don't have any authentic conversations. I said, boy, I'd agree with that. Christians, we're interested in monologue, not dialogue. And I think it's funny. My students, because that was parental. My students just read Sam Harris, Letter to a Christian Nation. I'm teaching a class on persuasion. Let's do the method of the dialectic, which is, can you argue both sides of an issue? Right? And so right now they're reading Sam Harris. Their first responsibilities, I want you to understand Sam Harris, an atheist, not critique him. That'll come later. First, understand him. And parents didn't like it. Roommates didn't like it. What are you doing reading Sam Harris? It's like, well, because if we're going to have a dialogue, you need to understand what Sam Harris is saying. But we don't want a dialogue. We want a monologue. We want to open the doors of our church or organization, go out, proclaim, and then come back in. As if we have nothing to learn. So when I applied to UNC Chapel Hill, it was funny. I was up with Campus Crusade for Christ was my employer. My graduate education was Reformed Theological Seminary. And this is UNC Chapel Hill. So when they looked at everything, Dr. Balthrop, the head of the department, asked me one question. Are you here to learn? And I said, yes. Yeah, I really am. He goes, good. Okay. Come on in. But are you here to proselytize? And just that, the answer is no. We don't want you. Learn while you're getting a master's and a PhD. Boy, that's great advice. First, let's learn and be good conversationalists. Not merely disagree, but demonize. Boy, we're really good at this. They do it to us, and we do it right back to them. We talk about postmoderns like they're absolute idiots. And they're not. I was at a... we speak for Family Life. And we are in this meeting, and they bring in a top expert. I won't mention the organization, but really well known. And he is talking about feminism. And this is what he said. He said, feminism, of course, grew out of the 1960s. It grew out of the sexual revolution, and that was the point of feminism. It was to remove restraints when it comes to our sexuality. That's what feminists want to do. I'm just sitting there. Dennis Rainey was sitting next to me, just happened to sit next to me. He's the head of Family Life. I said, do I have a green light to ask a question? He goes, yep. I said, excuse me, feminism came out of the 1960s? And the purpose of feminism was just to have sexual freedom? He goes, yeah. I said, well, what about, I don't know, the 1800s? And fighting for the right to vote? And fighting for the African-American right to vote? And the temperance movement? And Susan B. Anthony and Alice Paul? And he goes, there's older feminists. I said, well, another way of saying that is feminism existed before the 1960s. And he just kind of, this is in Skype, right? He's being Skyped in. And I'm just like, and he goes, well, I wanted to simplify. I said, can I push back a little bit? What's he going to say? He goes, yeah. I go, or distort. Right? People walking out of this room thinking that all feminists want is sexual freedom. Boy, we hate when people do that to us. Let's stop doing it to them. Right? Let's have nuanced views of people. That's why we keep the car running when we speak, by the way. Our cars, we have timed it. We can get out of here in about...
He'll be amazed.
15 seconds. Okay, next slide. By the way, the views represented here do not necessarily represent that of Biola University. Okay, so... All right, next slide. We're in a negative communication spiral right now, and it's ugly. So we want to show you what the argument culture actually looks like. So this is Bernie Sanders, and he is Russell Volt has been nominated by President Trump in a finance position, but he's a Wheaton graduate.
He's a budget geek that he's being interviewed geek. To become.
He's a Wheaton graduate, and Bernie Sanders has gotten a hold of something he wrote in college.
To the student newspaper.
Yeah, to the student newspaper. This is Bernie Sanders, his allotted 6-7 minutes, and this is how he spends it. We didn't test this, did we?
Yeah, but we're testing it now.
Can we? We are testing it now. That's good. Yeah.
You're going to have to mouse click on that to start it, unfortunately, I think.
Oh, here we go.
The position of Deputy Director of the White House Office of Management and Budget. Denigrated American Muslims and the Muslim faith. His writings demonstrate a clear hostility to religious pluralism and freedom that disqualify him for any appointment, including that of Deputy Director of the OMB. So, for the record. In the piece that I referred to that you wrote for a publication called Resurgent, you wrote, Muslim, quote, Muslims do not simply have a deficient theology. They do not know God because they have rejected Jesus Christ, his son, and they stand condemned. End of quote. Do you believe that that statement is Islamophobic?
Absolutely not, Senator. I'm a Christian, and I believe in a Christian set of principles based on my faith. That post, as I stated in the questionnaire to this committee, was to defend my alma mater, Wheaton College, a Christian school that has a statement of faith that includes the centrality of Jesus Christ for salvation. And
again, I apologize. I do forgive me. We just don't have a lot of time. Do you believe that people in the Muslim religion stand condemned? Is that your view?
Again, Senator, I'm a Christian, and I wrote that piece.
Well, what does that say?
The statement of faith, Wheaton.
I understand that. I don't know how many Muslims there are in America. I really don't know. Probably a couple of million. Are you suggesting that all of those people stand condemned? What about Jews? They stand condemned too?
Senator, I'm a Christian.
I understand you are a Christian, but this country is made up of people who are not just. I understand that Christianity is the majority religion, but there are other people who have different religions in this country and around the world. In your judgment, do you think that people who are not Christians are going to be condemned?
Thank you for probing on that question. As a Christian, I believe that all individuals are made in the image of God and are worthy of dignity and respect regardless of their religious beliefs. I believe that as a Christian, that's how I should treat all individuals.
And do you think your statement that you put into that publication, they do not know God?
Okay, we can stop it there.
Let's because they rejected you.
See, that's the argument culture. I don't think your position is merely wrong, and let's have a great debate about it. It's immoral. Your position is immoral. And the biggest pushback I got at UNC Chapel Hill is when I would start to talk about social issues after years of earning their respect, is they said, Tim, you want to be considered a compassionate racist. It doesn't work that way. Your views about homosexuality, your views about this, you want to be a compassionate racist. It doesn't. I don't care how compassionate you are. It's racist. It's homophobic. And I don't care if you're compassionate. See, the conversation's over before it ever begins. Now, we can bemoan that fact, and we can say, hey, that's really unfair, but our book is about, okay, but we still want to engage. I still want to have an authentic conversation. How in the world do you start it? To give it any chance of actually gaining momentum is what we try to explore in the book. So, Rick, next slide. We're in negative communication spirals today, which means I meet your negativity with my negativity. You stereotype me, I'll stereotype you. You shout down my experts, I'll shout down yours. Make fun of my people, I'll make fun of your people. We hit sarcasm with sarcasm. And I think the Bible has radically different ways of doing this, right? Next.
Hey, this is a great book. You should pick it up, Tim.
Hey, whoa. What? Oh, here we go.
We're coming back.
Oh, did the whole thing just go off?
Yeah.
Okay. So let me do this. We'll have an image up in a second. So we try to present test cases throughout the book and then ask the question, how in the world did that work? So I'm from Detroit, which, by the way, the Lions are undefeated and tied for first. Detroit Lions. Thank you. We have something your team doesn't. We have the most expensive player in football. And he threw a pick six his first pass. So, in the heart of Detroit, predominantly Catholic location, a group wanted to erect a statue. It was a 2-ton statue. The statue was a demonic-looking figure with two kids lovingly looking up at the statue. This is the Detroit chapter of the Satanic Temple. And they wanted to publicly do it. Oh, we'll get to that in a second. Hang on, Rick. So, how do you do that? How do you go to a predominantly Catholic city council and say, I want to erect a statue to Satan? Oh, here it is. Well, if they started with their conviction that Satan is a type of anti-culture and we ought to respect him, they're dead in the water. It's not going to go anywhere. They didn't do that. They created what is called the plausibility structure. See, when you're the minority perspective, I'm not going to persuade you in one fell swoop that my position is true. There's no way. I need to first get you to see that it's plausible. It's just possible that what I'm advocating might be true. So here's what they did. They met with the city council and they said, listen, we are deeply concerned that Catholics are being shut out of the public square. We think that persecution against religious voices is wrong. We think a naked public square is wrong, where science is allowed but religion is thrown out, right? That's Newhouse. So we want to fight absolutely for religious freedom, and we want you to know we have your back. And we support you. We absolutely support it. And they're like, well, okay, thank you. Duly noted. Thank you. And we would like to ask that you respect our religious voice. And we would like to express our religious voice in the form of a statue. And now the city council is like, doggone. But here's what a plausibility structure is. This is Peter Berger's take on it. He's a communication theorist. The plausibility structure is this. Can that city council member go back home and give a reasonable articulation of why he voted yes to the statute? That's a plausibility structure. Can I go back to my church and say, this is why I agreed with this, and not be just crucified? So you know what they did? They voted yes. It was unveiled 2 years ago. And they went back and they said, listen, I despise it. By the way, sign me up for the protest that'll happen. When this happens, put me front of the list. But they have every right to do it, because we have every right to speak what we say. And by the way, what we say is deeply offensive to a lot of people. So by the way, protest. Get the word out. But that statue is going up, because we think more important than that statue is religious freedom. Right? It's a plausibility structure that can maybe make it work.
And let me just pick up one thing on that, going back to the Bernie Sanders conversation about kind of the interesting ways you can appeal to a plausibility structure. It would have been great if Russell Voigt had just said, I believe about Muslims exactly what Muslims believe about me. And that is indeed that I don't believe accurately of God, and my inaccurate beliefs of God put me on the wrong side in terms of my eternal destiny. And by the way, that's also what a Hindu or a Buddhist might believe, and I know you don't think of it that way, but when you tell a person, well, everyone gets saved, how? By being reincarnated until you become a Hindu. Oh, which is code word for only Hindus can be saved. But one day, you benighted young man who's a Christian will wake up and be properly Hindu, and yeah, you'll work your way up through a set of castes, and you'll finally get your way to, you know, your eternal destiny. I said, and the thing that places an obligation upon religious people is to learn ways to get along with those whom they profoundly disagree with. And suddenly you have a plausibility structure for your Christianity. As long as we're the only people on the planet who are exclusivists, we seem really implausible. If we suddenly realize, oh, every religion has that claim, don't even bother pointing out that it's possible Bernie was being just a little judgmental to this guy. Yeah. We'll leave that to the side. I'm just saying, let's think about religion and the obligations that come to being successfully being a religious person. And that is, I have to learn to love, care for, and work with people with whom I have a disagreement concerning their eternal destiny. That's just my daily diet. And that isn't true for most people. I understand that. But that's part of the game, and that's part of the game for every religion. So those are some of these things that suddenly make what looks like an outlying line belief a lot more plausible. It's very helpful to take some time ahead of time to think through those things, because they don't have a way of coming up from someone who's carefully signaled their turns. I'm about to sucker you in and knock you upside the head with this one, so get ready. They don't do that. You just suddenly are in the Senate and they're grilling you over what really is not only a piece of Christian orthodoxy, but basically ubiquitous in world religions.
And we have to engage in perspective taking. In other words, if I might have said, and again, it's so easy to quarterback this, Russell Bowen,
yeah,
poor guy, is sitting right there. I love it. Thank you so much for probing in this area. That's great.
Please stop.
But here's what I might want to say. I want to say, Senator Sanders, if I had your view of my faith, I would be opposed to myself as well. I think that's so important to say. If I saw the world the way you do, and the way you view my faith, I'd be opposed to it as well. See, my students are also reading another book called Rescuing Jesus. A woman, a sociologist, went to Biola, Wheaton, Azusa, and did interviews, transgendered students, same-sex attracted students, and it was all anonymous. We don't know who these students were. And she basically said, how were you treated at these Christian universities? And it's horrible. Biola University is right there. It is all throughout the book. So if I'm Senator Laura in Sacramento, who very much wants to close down Christian universities, if I had that view of Biola University, I'd be mad. I'd be upset. I'd be like, you're darn right we're closing these universities, because you can't treat students that way. So sometimes it's really good just to stop long enough to say, if I saw the world the way this person sees it, then I would be upset. So let me try to give you a more nuanced view of what you believe, a more complex view of what you believe. But sometimes when you view certain things a certain way, you go, I get where your anger is coming from, and I'd be angry too. Can I give you a counter interpretation of what my community is trying to do? Might be helpful. But hey, go through this chart, Rick. This chart's great.
So one of the observations I had as I thought back about evangelical discourse in the public square is that we have been speaking in a prophetic voice to our public for several decades. You know, let's go back to the 1980s and Jerry Falwell and all that. A prophetic voice that basically is declaring the truth, calling people to repent and change and, you know, get right, straighten up and fly right, sort of a voice. And I'd like to point out that that is one of the voices we hear the Holy Spirit speaking to us in. So the Holy Spirit, one of the things he does is convict the world concerning truth and righteousness and judgment, right? So this is not a bad thing. What's wrong with you for being prophetic? I'm like, no, this is a totally, not only viable, but a necessary part of a Christian voice. But here's the rub. After a while, people become sort of inoculated to that. And then we get upset because we keep declaring our prophetic truth and people keep not responding. And then we do the American tourist abroad thing, which is when you say, I want dinner at 5, and the French waiter has this look like, I do not understand what you say to me. You know, he doesn't speak a word of English. So then you say, I want dinner at 5. And then he still doesn't understand you. And then you say, read my lips. And you keep repeating things in the same voice and they keep not hearing you. And so one of the things we need to get an imagination for is saying, wait a minute, the Holy Spirit has other ways he speaks to us too, right? So he has a prophetic voice. He also has a pastoral voice. He's called the paraclete, the one who comes alongside. I mean, I'm talking to a batch of people who are interested in counseling kinds of things here. So yeah, that's part of one of the voices the Holy Spirit brings to us. The other thing is he has a persuasive voice. He's the one who's going to be guiding us into all the truth. Not simply so we can know that factoid exists, but so that we believe it, right? It's a persuasive sort of a thing he's trying to do. And I think what's happened is somehow in our imagination, we think the only way for me to be a faithful Christian is to speak prophetically. And I would like to say you might be able to be a faithful Christian by speaking pastorally. And you might be able to be a faithful Christian by speaking, well, persuasively. And one kind of final footnote on this. I feel like what's kind of happened is my generation came up shouting prophetically. My kids' generation came up watching us yell at French waiters and being really embarrassed. So they have adopted the pastoral voice naturally. They come alongside, they understand, they love, they accept people where they're at. The worst thing you could do is judge someone. This is descriptive of my generation, you know, evangelical kids, you know, for my kids' generation. That is profoundly what they do. And the thing that I am afraid we have missed with that is the notion of persuasion. Because at some point you want to stop and ask yourself, do I actually believe that anything the Bible says is true? Do I believe that God could give a command that said certain behaviors are immoral and displeasing to him? Do I believe that a person might actually be in peril of their soul for disbelieving or rejecting Jesus, or saying things like, if Jesus doesn't love gays, well, they're, you know, if he isn't okay with gay sex, I'm not okay with Jesus. These are phrases I have heard. And I want to say, are we loving people when we don't attempt to persuade them to see that differently, but are simply happy to say, hey, and I love you too, pal. And they walk away. The nice thing about Christians, they love you even when you hate them and disbelieve everything they affirm. And I'm like, you know, it would be nice if they would hear a prophetic voice. It would be nice if they heard a pastoral voice. But it would be nice at the end of the day to make sure that somewhere they were getting a persuasive voice that was trying to move the needle. And by the way, once you understand that they are somehow your goal, you've shifted from the notion that the person you're thinking about when you do communication is you. So the prophetic voice, usually people are speaking that so they feel good that they have been faithful to Jesus. And then I have stood on the watchtower, I have declared the message, and then the blood is on their head and not mine because I have declared, you know, from in the Ezekiel image there, and I've washed my hands. Similar, where I want this person to know I'm loving. I want this person to love me. I don't want to have tension in my relationship. So you're thinking about you with the thing. And the persuasive thing demands that you think about what's going on in their mind. What is it that they care about? What is it that I can do to help them think differently about what's in their mind right now? And persuasion is just necessarily others focused. Whereas this prophetic and the pastoral thing, and I would have said pastoral is necessarily others focused because you're busy loving them. But as I've seen it in action, I've suddenly become really worried that an awful lot of it is really a concern that I'm being loved back. And the worst thing that could ever happen is that one of my friends or acquaintance would somehow think me less than fully loving. Yeah. So we zip our lip when it might come time to speak a word. And that's a real tension. So this one chart in some ways distills a huge amount of what we're saying into saying we've got to recover these other voices. And for some people, what they need to do is say, wow, there is a place for the prophetic, but I need to worry about the persuasive. For other people, could you tone down the prophetic line and think about the people you're talking to? So,
because the question, Rick, is, you, and the way you said it is, do you want to really move the needle? Do you want to do that? Because if we're here, right, if there's this gap between us, moving the needle can't start with, I want to erect a two-ton statue of Satan with two children lovingly looking. That's not going to work. So if I really want to move the needle, I'm going to have to come at this winsomely. I'm going to have to come at this and give some ground. I'm going to laugh at some things. I'm going to do some things. But here's what's going to happen. The minute you do this, your congregation is going to say, what's up with you? That was a mishy-mashy. What was that? You had a chance to proclaim God, and your answer was this? And I'm like, so in the book we talk about Rob Bell made a decision. Now listen, Rob Bell's hanging out with Oprah, one of the most powerful women we can think of. Oprah is a culture changer. Now let's assume for the second that Rob Bell really wants to move the needle on how Oprah thinks about Christianity and Jesus. Oprah's defenses are up. I mean, it's fortified. I've seen her really lay waste to some Christians. So what's Rob Bell supposed to do? Well, whatever he's going to do, and let's say we trust him that he really wants to do this, whatever he's going to do with Oprah, we're going to say is soft, lukewarm, and I didn't like what you did. But if he comes out and says, Oprah, Jesus really is Lord, and I'm sorry that your spirituality, you love the fact that our religions lead to God, whoever he, she, it is, but I'm telling you right now, Jesus is Lord, that's one conversation and you're done. You just lost the audience. It's gone. It was prophetic. It was true, but you just lost the audience. So we got asked the question, if we want to get to all aspects of our community, we're going to have a message that other parts of the community can hear and at least start a conversation with them. And that means we're going to have to, this is where it gets really controversial, it means there is no private dialogue anymore. Our private has become public very quickly. So we're going to have to change the way we actually talk about people within our churches. So I was speaking to a conference and this is, Rick and I do not agree on everything. Actually, the third section of the book is we have an interesting guided disagreement about what to do now that same-sex marriage is the law of the land. What should we do as counterpublics? So I was talking about transgendered bathrooms, and I actually make a case where I think we should support them. Okay, we can talk about that later. I think we should support them. But a pastor came up to me, and we didn't know each other, and he said, oh, I got a solution to the bathroom issue. Let's have three bathrooms, he, she, it. And I just looked at him and I said, hey, we don't know each other, but can I just say something, brother to brother? You cannot call a person made in God's image an it. And he said, well, you know, I was just kidding. I said, well, that made it worse. Haven't been invited back, you know. But right? But we're going to think, if we really want to move the needle, we're going to have some really interesting conversations with our community. And one place to start is, I think everyone within this community ought to have a right to go to the bathroom. I think everybody here should have the freedom to go to the bathroom. Now, let's start there. Now, maybe at the end of the day, we can't go there. At the end of the day, we're finally going to have to say no. We can't. So let's find an alternative because we can't sign off on that. But let's not start there. Let's start with compassion and grace. You don't run up to a traffic accident, put your head into the car and say, see, should have been wearing your seatbelt. Right? You just don't do that. So I think the pastoral voice, we need more of that today to show that we really do love people. We really do care about you. We want our churches to be a place where you can come and be in process. Right? So that's...
And a little side note on this. The thing, the historical examples I have in the book, you would find, if you wanted to, examples of all of these examples that we're giving, actually using all three of these voices.
Yeah.
So, I mean, St. Patrick has a wonderful story, and the things he did were remarkable. And positive vision for human culture is a big part of what's changing around. By the way, some of his confrontations with these warlords will make your skin crawl. It's amazing stories, very combative, very prophetic. You have this rich mix of both ending. And so when we're talking about this, we're saying we're trying to change and expand our discourse. That's different than saying, never speak a prophetic word, or it's always wrong to prophetic.
And so a guy just asked me, this was literally yesterday morning, on a radio interview. He goes, give me an example of the prophetic, when you would speak the prophetic. I thought, that's a great question. Sorry, we're out of time. No, that's a great question. I said, to me, it's Charlottesville. The church comes out and says, sorry, hate groups are wrong. And we denounce hate groups. And if for some reason you think that you're taking what I'm saying and justifying your hatred, that's wrong. Don't be taking the scripture and using it that way. I denounce hate groups. Right? Now somebody might say, well, then don't you want to reach the skinheads? Yes, I do. But there comes a time where the church stands up and we're prophetic. We're saying this is wrong and we're denouncing it with everything within us. I think we can do that with bullying. Right? We can say, listen, bullying is wrong. And I don't care what a person believes in this country. We don't beat up people from the Satanic Temple. We don't beat up people that we disagree with. And if somehow our rhetoric has added to that, then please tell us how our rhetoric is adding to this idea that you think we condone that type of action. In the strongest possible words, we denounce bullying and hatred and homophobia and stuff like that, right?
We have about 15 minutes. Do I just go to questions?
Yeah, let's just go to questions. Okay. We're dying to know what you think.
We have other stuff we can talk about, but hey, let's take questions from you guys about anything that may have come up in this conversation.
Feel free to disagree. Feel free to...
We do disagree with each other on any variety. We just were talking about issues this morning.
Yeah, this morning.
Disagreeing
with
each other, so it's fine. Yes. Oh, yes, there you go.
I appreciate the perspective and when to be prophetic, because I think I'm navigating those three areas all the time and earning the right to be heard. Can I ask you to give an example of prophetic on a interpersonal way? Because my thoughts that I even want to communicate to our crowd on a Sunday morning after Charlottesville is one thing, but how do I be prophetic to someone in my life interpersonally? When do I go to that realm?
Yeah. So Paul says there are things you are to put on and things you are to put off. You're to put on compassion, sympathy. You're to put off these rotted words. You slander each other. You devour each other. So I do think there comes a time in a person's life where I have the credibility to say it. You see, we can't just throw out communication theory. If the climate, if the communication climate isn't strong enough, then all you're going to do is send that person away. You've just made the climate worse. But I do think with somebody in the congregation, I can say, listen, that you just can't talk about a person that way. You just can't. I'm sorry. That was really uncharitable. And I think we have a good enough relationship for me to say that to you. And I think, and listen, I've done stuff like that too, but you can't be talking about people like that. I think that's prophetic.
I spent 20 years as a pastor. I don't know how these things happen sometimes, but I end up becoming the guy in charge of church discipline. So my nickname was Dr. Discipline. So I spent time being as prophetic as you could possibly imagine with people, where I said, you know, what you're doing is not only wrong, but it's actually incompatible with fellowship in a body of believers, and you need to decide where you're actually going to stand on this. And I had people, I mean, we disfellowshiped someone, and I had someone in the back of the room afterwards going whack, 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 whack with his index finger in my chest about how dare you be so judgmental, unforgiving, all those kinds of things. This person was actually a Christian leader. And I said, you know, I don't think I actually enjoyed this any more than you did. So if you could just explain to me how I can make sense of these passages of Scripture and not disfellowship a person who's doing the behaviors that this person was, I would really appreciate it. Because I didn't see how I did that, and I felt obliged to either choose to honor Scripture or, on the alternative, I could ignore this behavior and let it just go, but I didn't feel like there was a way to put two together. But if there is a way, I'd love to have you explain it to me. Well, I thought that was really nice. Wasn't that nice? Give me a little applause for a little nice. It didn't work. It totally didn't. He was still, you know, the steam was coming off his ears. And this is one of those things I would encourage you to remember. We're talking about this. We're not holding out this magic thought that whenever you approach things well, you get a good result.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just don't. And so I had quite a variety of these interactions. But I spent a lot of time being very direct with people about that. And very rarely did I end up with those relationships having gone bad. And that would actually include some people that we actually disfellowshiped from the church.
I think it sounds like almost like speaking truth in love, you earn the right to tell them the true story, or helping them to see kind of what their destruction behavior is going to be like. But if you don't earn the right to do that by loving them, then you're not engaging. So how would you see that as, like with these three voices?
So one of the things, back to being a pastor, so I don't know, you know, where everybody is. There, some of you, I'm sure, are more counseling areas, some more pastoring area. One of the interesting things when you talk about, you know, needing a relationship with the person to be able to share with them, I would like to point out there's part of that that actually comes from a role. So as both pastors and counselors, you actually have an interesting standing. You're not building from ground zero. You're actually walking into this conversation with a measure of an existing role that gives you not only right, but I would argue responsibility to communicate certain truths. And one of the things I did a lot with people, just explain that to them. I had this issue with who will you marry? And you have somebody in the, you know, you're having this discussion, these two, one's a believer, one's not a believer. And one of the things I tell them, said, look, you need to understand why and how I do weddings. The only reason I'm able to do a wedding is because I have been ordained and appointed to this through our elder board and then also through a denomination. But it's absolutely dependent upon a kind of a biblical mandate that they have recognized and entrusted me with. So there's a million other ways to have a wedding done. But if you're going to have it done through me, my responsibility entails that I maintain biblical versions of this. And one of the tensions we hit is when we're marrying a believer with a non-believer, And what your spouse, your fiancé, has just communicated is explicitly that she doesn't actually believe, but you've communicated that she does. So that kind of leaves me in a trap. And all of this, these are people that I only know from having them come in to talk to me about doing the wedding. But there is part of the position that I have that opens the door and, like I say, conveys the responsibility. And it's really easy. It's kind of handy because you can say, I'm not saying this because I woke up this morning and said, let me say something I think might be hurtful to somebody. I'd say, I feel like this is a responsibility that travels with the role I've been entrusted with. And I totally understand that you may disagree with that, but I wouldn't be faithful if I didn't communicate that to you.
And I would only add one quick thing to that. So I do think it's context-driven. So I was, now E.D. Free Fullerton has a great pastor, Darren McWaters. He's awesome. He's doing a great job. But I was the interim for about a year and a half. Highly prophetic, right? The fact that you're standing in the place Chuck Swindoll stood, right? That's highly prophetic. Now I'm at Vox. For a bunch of different reasons I can't publicly share, due to it's a good place for certain people in my life to attend. But now I'm on the teaching team, and these are people who said, I will never set my foot in a church again, ever, ever. And they did. Mike got him back. Mike Geary got him back. Whatever you think of him, he got him back. Now, some of them are a mess. And it's like, well, now I can't step and say, well, you need to really get yourself fixed up right now. But you know, they're like, ah, I knew it. And they're gone. I said, well, at least I spoke the truth. Yeah, but they're gone, never to come back. So Vox is, it is a, and I'm learning, it is a walk on the wild side. And I really commend what's happening there. There are people you would never see at other churches, ever. And I think what Mike did was remarkable. And now, it's sadly, he left to care for his mother. But, so what do you do with those people? Well, I don't think you kick into the prophetic, unless it's life-threatening, this is an intervention type thing. But it's going to be pastoral, right? And it's a different way for me to... I was on the debate team in college. I can kick into the prophetic in a heartbeat. But I just wonder, so we look at the culture today, and I think we have to be pastoral. Because they don't believe that we care for them. There were two sociologists, UNC Chapel Hill, they wrote a book while I was there. They picked one word to describe evangelicals. You know what the word was? Mean. You're just mean. You pick on people. You pick on the gay community. You pick on women on welfare. You pick on women stressed out getting an abortion. And those are the people you pick on? Said, you're just mean. And I thought, oh my word, what happened to neighbor love? And so I think we have to change our voice right now. And it's going to come across wishy-washy. It's going to come across so slow. But again, if we really want to move the needle, we're going to have to change our tactics, I think. And you earn the right to be heard. I think that's true. I really do. More questions.
So as a pastor, part of my concern is how can we help our people as they are out in their particular contexts and neighborhoods and workplaces put themselves in the way appropriately to be persuasive in this case. You know, as a pastor, so much of my universe is the church, and as academics you're going to be in that sort of context as well, and so it kind of makes sense for us. I feel like it's almost easier in certain sense because we're preaching to the choir. What have you found as helpful contexts for the average guy to get an opportunity to engage these conversations, particularly in an environment where so much of the environment is sort of non-starter environments? You know, you got these, we're demonized and we're, you know, bumper stickered, you know, so to speak, and all these sort of vilification that's happening. You feel like you can't even get to first base, as you were talking about. So are there, the book Good Faith, which your guys are familiar with, I'm sure, you know, speaks about these issues as well, and a big piece to that, I think their argument is Christian hospitality, is to engage in relationships through hospitality, as to kind of get them in the door, actually care about these people, really care about them relationally as friends, and then maybe you can get there this way. But what has your sort of experience been to good sort of examples of how this fleshes out.
So a book that really changed my perspective is a book called The Rise of Christianity by Rodney Stark. He's a sociologist. And he went back and asked the question, okay, how did the church really grow? Like, what happened? And he points to three plagues that hit the Roman Empire. And the church really made the decision, we're going to go out and help people. I mean, this is people dying in the streets, right? And they made a decision to go. So I want to encourage people to be good neighbors, good local neighbors, and especially with the people who don't like you. This is what Paul's saying. Boy, when those who hate you are hungry, I want you to feed them. So in my grad program, man, there were people who hated me. I'd walk in a room and conversations would stop because they were talking about me. But I made a breakthrough in some ways because when people are at their lowest, I made the decision to try to minister in small ways. And I do think we teach our people to be, this is what it means to know, what's the heartbeat of your cul-de-sac? What's the heartbeat of three doors down, three doors across, and three doors to your right? What's that? And do things, offer things. I was at one church in North Carolina where they set up once a month. It was an open, all the car mechanics in the church said, anyone can come, especially young single mothers. Come, we'll fix everybody's car. And what we can do. Another person got the idea, well, let's do that with dental issues. So she, again, that kind of stuff, that's what I love about the local church, is word gets out that we're here for you. And I think that hopefully bleeds into the congregation. So some of you participate in Love Fullerton thing that's been happening, that now we have police chiefs joining and stuff like that. But I think that kind of thing opens doors. At the end of the day, if people know I really do care about you, well, you know, we bitterly disagree, but okay, set that aside. Set it aside. How can we help? And so I think... But here's what happens with the young generation. I'd love to get your take on this. So here's what I see with millennials. They love that. Oh, I'll do that all day long. I'll do it all day long. And then I say, but listen, when's the last time you shared the gospel? And by gospel, I mean this. You present the gospel and ask that person, what would you do with Christ? Would you like to receive Christ right now? They look at me like, no. I'm living my faith. And I said, man, I applaud that. I think social justice is the DNA of the church. I really think it is. But so is proclamation of the gospel. When's the last time you shared your faith? I did a survey once, all year, zero was the average. So I want to say to students, and I just preached this at Vox, by the way, and we start every service with questions that are texted in, and I got pushback from everybody. Say, no, that's not me. I'd never do that. I said, well, that's half the gospel. We need to do both. And millennials are like, I'll dig a clean water well. I'll do it right now. I'll do it through concrete. But I am not sharing my faith with a person and ask them to accept Jesus as their Savior? Mm-mm, not going to do that. And I said, man, I don't think you're representing what the New Testament church did. So I think we have to be careful here. It can go too far. So we have to have a balanced approach.
And one real quick follow-up on this is just ask people questions. So I did my PhD at UC Riverside in philosophy. So I was not surrounded by people who shared my viewpoint. I'm sitting out in the quad one day. This guy goes walking by, just says hi. You know, a guy that I'd had in class, we knew each other's name, literally never talked. And so, you know, he was walking by, and he said hi, and I said hi, and we began chatting a little bit. And I just asked him this question. How did you first fall in love with philosophy? And he goes, oh, it was so weird. I was reading, and he talks for an hour about this class he had as a sophomore where he read Plato. And then you know what the most natural question in the world is to follow that up with from his end? How about me? Yeah. So I tell him a story about, and for me, my story always comes back to something that's intersected with Christ, right? So asking people these questions and then listening, and that possibly for a long time, and others are not always so thoughtful that after they've talked for an hour and said, wow, this was a really wonderful hour, see you later, and they won't follow. That's fine. Be a listener and be an asker. Care to hear the story. You know, you say you're an atheist. That's interesting to me. I know it sounds weird, but that's interesting. Tell me your story. And let them talk. Yeah. And it's amazing what you opened up. You have somewhere back there, there's a microphone in a hand. Yeah.
Yeah, so you must have been reading my mind because it seems like it's important to lead with a good question, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I think that was Jesus' style.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Go figure. But so how do you help people develop good questions to start off with or even to continue the conversation or to take it to the next level?
You know, one thing I would say is be sincerely curious about people.
Yeah.
You know, literally, they tell you something, oh, wow, you grew up in Iran? How was that? Tell me the story. It's not a complicated question. And the funny thing is all the things that spin out of that. And just keep people talking, and you'll find some really interesting threads to have conversations with people on. And so that's, I think, one area I'd just say, just be curious, be authentically interested in other people. And ask questions that show it. And I think you'll find a lot of things come from that, even without a magic question.
But you're intuitive at that, though, I would say. We have great conversations. I would say you're a great listener. I think a lot of people aren't intuitive that way. It just doesn't come naturally. And they're in the argument culture. So I think we're going to have to actually model it, help model it from up front, and then help people do this. Because I think some people just aren't good communicators, and they don't know how to exactly do that. So I think we're going to have to model it for them and give them a way to think about it, kind of stuff like that, because I think some people, it just doesn't click. It doesn't work for them. Yeah.
And this is for Tim. You've used the phrase move the needle. Could you clarify or define what you mean by moving the needle? I mean, are we talking more than just acceptability, respectability from those that we disagree with? Please.
So let me give you a great illustration of this. So I was on staff with Campus Crusade for Christ for 30 years, me and my wife. Loved it. It was part of their training people in evangelism, apologetics. And then God just really moved my heart. Right down the road was UNC Chapel Hill. So I went and did a master's and loved it enough to do a PhD. So I'm slugging it out day in and day out. I mean, they know that I'm part of their department, right? You're supporting people in their projects. They're supporting you in your projects and blah, 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 blah. So a guy comes up to me, a Campus Crusade for Christ guy, who knows I'm on staff. I'm just doing full-time grad work. He says, listen, can I buy you a coffee? So we buy coffee. And he says, listen, I want to put something in everybody's mailbox. Maybe a chapter from like C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. And that way I can find out who's interested spiritually. And I just looked at him and I said, one, that's proselytizing. That's the worst thing you can do. Two, nobody's going to read it. No one's going to read C.S. Lewis. So basically what you want to do is, you don't want to invest at all in my department. You just want to stick things in people's mailboxes. Well, let me just tell you right now, that's not going to persuade anybody. If anything, it's going to send them away from you. So if my goal is in a department where everybody is anti-Christian to a certain point, and they're postmodern to a certain point, and they're pro- gay, that, and they're non-starters everywhere. I actually want to move the needle what they think about Christianity. I want them to change how they think about Christianity. How do you do that? I want to build in the middle of UNC Chapel Hill a 2-ton statue to Jesus. And if I start there, they're going to say no. Get out of here. We're not doing that. So how do you start? So I went into this gender class. We have one of the top feminist theorists in the world, teaches at UNC Chapel, Julia Witt. She was my dissertation director. I walked into that class, the only thing I knew about feminism is it was wrong. That's it. My pastor said it. When I became a Christian at age 13, he said, feminism is the worst threat to the church in the history of the church. Hello, narrow, take number two, right? Well, what? So all I knew, seriously, walking in, it's wrong. This is wrong. And I'll never forget Julia getting up and doing an introduction to feminism. And I was like, wow, I sort of kind of agree with that. So you know what I did? I did exactly what you did. That first semester, I was her teaching assistant. There were 10 of us.
I was like, Julia, I'm reading your textbook, Gender, Culture, and Communication. It's brilliant. She's like, oh, thank you. I said, there's parts I disagree with. I didn't say that, but man, this, man, that's great. And she's like, wow. Yeah, thank you. So again, it's I respect you. I want to. It wasn't BS, right? That's what Plato would say the sophist did. I'm just softening you up for the kill. Plato hated that. But I'm not. I'm generally like, yeah, really good stuff. And then I later said to her, I want to do a presentation called Jesus the Feminist. She's like, oh, I love that. And I said, let's do it. I think I'm a Christian feminist. And she goes, oh, we've always wanted one of those. And I'm like, yeah.